This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, we explore how breast cancer survivors can find the support they need. Plus, we'll examine the problems that are caused by varicose veins. But first, one man's journey into a stroke and out again. Stroke is the leading cause of disability in the United States and the fourth most prevalent cause of death, killing nearly 130,000 Americans each year. But what we know when it comes to stroke is that time is brain. That means that the time is of the essence when preserving life and brain function. We'll hear with a personal story of his journey is Onondaga County Under Sheriff Warren Darby and Dr. Jean Latore, Associate Professor of Neurology at Upstate Medical University. Welcome to you both. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
So, Under Sheriff Darby, you recently suffered a stroke. Can you walk us through your experience? When was it and what happened?
It was in the middle of the summer of 2013, July 18th. It was a bright, sunny day. It was the day that the Valleymans Field Days set up for their annual rides and fair down in Meacham Park on the south side of the city. When they set up all those rides, the first day, the morning of the first day, they keep it secured for just special kids from all over the city and county, and they bus them in from all over. And the police, fire, and EMS folk go down there and help the kids on the rides. I have been for years been doing this because I have a Down syndrome daughter who, when she was a youngster, would go there too. And I am the bumper car specialist. If they can't drive the bumper cars by themselves, I'm in the car with them, having probably as much fun as they were.
I bet.
So we were looking forward to a good day. I was in uniform going to work at about, I had breakfast at 7 in the morning, going to work, and got there about 8. At 9 o'clock was the detail down to Meacham, so I had an hour to get some stuff done. And as I got out of the car down at headquarters, I felt an imbalance. I thought at first vertigo, but it wasn't a spinning feeling. It was just an imbalance. And so I had to steady myself, take time to get into the office, got in, sat down, did some work, and was feeling okay until I had to get up again for something. And about 45 minutes later, and the same feeling the second time. And that was enough for me to say there's something going on. I'm married to a nurse, so I called Joni and said, we probably need to see a doctor. Something's happening, and I probably shouldn't drive until we find out what it is.
That was very, very keen thinking. I'm not sure everyone would have that kind of forethought and ability.
If there's an imbalance, you don't want to be driving. So I waited for her to get down. When about 45 minutes, 50 minutes later, she got to the office, called me in the office from her cell, said, I'm outside. I got up that third time. That was the very third time. At that point, my left leg from the hip to the toe was numb and tingling like it had fallen asleep. Similar feelings when you sleep on your arm funny or something and you wake up and the circulation or something's been cut off. And that was the first time that I started to think maybe stroke as a sign of a potential problem with the brain. Worked my way out to the car with the help of my secretary and got in, and we stopped up to Dr. Mitch Brodies, who's my primary physician, who was expecting me because of the initial issue. And we both talked about the signs and symptoms. He took my blood pressure. I am on blood pressure medicine, have been for about 10 years. And I was up 178 over 118, I believe was the BP. We both agreed that we need to rule out stroke at that point, and the next thing I knew, I was in an ambulance, an ALS ambulance, on the way to the stroke center. And when we got to the stroke center, they were waiting for us. The doors opened, there was a room ready, and there was a team already there waiting for me.
Wow. So, Dr. Latore, he obviously did have a stroke.
He did.
There are a number of kinds of strokes. Can you take us through that? And what type of stroke did Mr. Darby have?
Yes, there are two types of stroke. One is we call ischemic stroke, wherein there is a blood clot that went up to your brain and clogged one of the artery, causing lack of blood flow.
Is that the more common
type? It's the more common. In a typical Caucasian population, it represents about 80 to 85% of the stroke.
Where and a then clot there's the, travels.
Where
and
the
then
clot
somehow
travels and somehow blocks one of the artery, causing the stroke because of the lack of blood flow. The second type of stroke, which Warren had, is called the hemorrhagic stroke. It's when a blood vessel ruptures and causes blood to ease out of the artery into your brain tissues. And that represents somewhere around 15 to 20% of strokes. Now, if you are African-American or if you're of an Asian background, the range are a little bit higher. So
For hemorrhagic.
It ranges anywhere from 30 to 35%.
So the brain ruptures, and is what are the underlying reasons for a hemorrhagic stroke versus an ischemic stroke, or are there underlying causes?
So there are different risk factors for the two. So for hemorrhagic stroke, the most common causes are weakening of the arteries related to long-standing hypertension. So if your blood pressure has been uncontrolled, or even if it's controlled, if it's been a while that you've been hypertensive, then you are at a higher risk of having a hemorrhagic stroke as opposed to an ischemic stroke. There are other conditions that weakens your arteries. Most important one that anybody can prevent is smoking. So smoking, if you inhale smoke, it has a lot of toxins that can be very irritable and damages the arteries, and that can cause a weakening of the arteries, leading to hemorrhagic stroke in the future.
So smoking and high blood pressure are both very important cause factors.
Smoking and high blood pressure,
potential
yes. Those are most of the important risk factors for hemorrhagic stroke.
And both of those can be avoided or controlled.
Hypertension can be very well controlled. You just have to make sure that you work with your primary care physician to make sure that it's controlled. And the smoking, anybody
can stop, hopefully.
Stop smoking. Yep.
Yeah, with all the new devices and new ways to try to do
exactly.
That. How about for the ischemic strokes? What are some of the risk factors there, as you mentioned, and what can be done to prevent it?
Yeah, so there are several types of ischemic strokes. We have about five types of ischemic stroke. We have a stroke that is caused by a blood clot coming from your heart. If you have what we call an atrial fibrillation or an irregularity of your heartbeat, then you are more prone to what we call a cardioembolic stroke or a stroke where the blood clot comes from the heart. There are what we call an atherosclerotic stroke. This is a stroke that is caused by a deposits of cholesterol
plaque
in your arteries, on your neck, as well as inside your brain. And when the plaque occludes or makes your artery, the inside of your artery smaller, it sometimes prevents blood flow from going into your brain, and that causes the stroke.
If you're just joining us or listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air, I'm Linda Cohen here with Undersheriff Warren Darby and neurologist Dr. Jean LaTorre. We're talking about stroke and the importance of getting the right care quickly. I want to turn very quickly. So how do you diagnose, how is it diagnosed, and why is that really important to diagnose it quickly?
So stroke is diagnosed by a specialist in the hospital using a number of tests. The most important test that we do for stroke is a CAT scan of your brain. This differentiates between a hemorrhagic stroke and an ischemic stroke. If you come to the hospital, you will get a CAT scan, and a neurologist or a specialist in stroke will come and evaluate you. Hospitals that are designated as stroke center have a team that comes to the emergency room every time that there is a stroke patient coming to evaluate the patient as soon as possible.
And know how to treat them properly or
exactly.
Appropriately. And as we said, time is of the essence. So is that probably why it's so important to come to a designated stroke center?
That is very correct. Every minute, 1.9 billion cells in the brain dies. When you're having a stroke, every minute counts. And so the sooner you come to the hospital, the sooner a treatment, if you are eligible, can be given, and the better your chance of improving from your stroke.
And Warren, you had that opportunity. You came directly to a stroke, designated stroke center when you came to Upstate, and you found that they really took over and took care of your care. There's an irony in some of this, in that in your history and your background, you actually played a role in some of these stroke designations. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, I've been involved with EMS since 1962, and I was part of the state EMS council that put together with CMAC, the State Medical Advisory Committee, the stroke center ideas. And so I had the privilege about 10 years or so prior to be working on that kind of a project, and I had opportunity to see it work. And they were waiting, just as the team, as the doctor said, they were there waiting for me. I had that CAT scan. They identified where the bleed was on the right side of my brain. And the next 3-4 days, we went through all kinds of testing to prove I had a brain. And I wanted a picture to bring back to the office for
to
that.
Prove
but
it.
They immediately treated. And that was. And my issue was, although I was hypertensive, knew I was a hypertensive patient for 10 years, have been dealing with it, the particular blood pressure medication that I was on, the pharmaceutical company pulled off the market, and they put me onto a generic a couple of months before the stroke. And what I didn't know was that the generic was identically the same chemistry, but had different transport agents in it, and it was supposed to be a 24-hour coverage. And apparently at the end of the 24, I wasn't being covered. And
wow.
Who takes their blood pressure at 4 o'clock in the morning to find out that you're not covered?
Wow.
I took my pills at 7 o'clock that morning, but they hadn't got into my system yet. And
wow.
So they tell
me
that probably was the issue, is that I was trying to treat it by my primary care physician, but we didn't know that the generic wasn't handling the full 24 hours.
That's fair. That raises a whole other can of worms in terms of generic versus,
brand name
drugs. But we're fortunate that you had a place to go that people could know exactly what to do. So how are you doing now?
Not 100% yet, but it's only 9.5 months away from the event.
And you sustained no cognitive problems.
That's
Is that correct? You had no true brain injury.
They told me I had about 50% balance issue, and that I had the left leg from the hip down. Other than that, no cognitive issues, and the rehab that started immediately after the release from the stroke center started to deal with it. I was on a walker for a couple of weeks, went to a cane, and then over the next couple of months with rehab worked off to where I have to keep the cane within reach. So it's in my car as we speak.
That's pretty far away.
But I'm back to full-time police duties, and hopefully.
And I've heard you're also fishing and hunting.
Well, I asked a good doctor whether fishing would be good rehab, and my wife was standing next to me, and I could see by her body language she didn't appreciate that question. But he turns out to be a fisherman too, and he gave me a very clear, be careful getting in and getting out. But the balance issue is what I'm going to be doing in rehab. When you get some movement in the boat, you just keep be careful. And I couldn't lift anything over 10 pounds. And I told him I hadn't caught a 10-pound fish out of a Niagara lake in a long time. So that was okay.
So it looks like you really are, it's a winning story.
God
a
is good
story
all the time.
For all of us. And it sounds like, Dr. Latore, what is being offered here at this designated stroke center is really a winning story as well.
That's correct.
Have you, is your feeling at this point that because of that kind of designation and that kind of help, that a lot of patients are having this kind of positive experience?
Yes. From my experience, we have a lot of patients who benefit from stroke, which used to be people think that it's incurable, that, you know, once you have a stroke, you're it. But now we see patients who are very, very sick, probably sometimes sicker than Warren, and goes home in 3 to 4 days. Sometimes they don't even go to rehab. They go back home as if nothing happened. So there are a lot of things that we can do for stroke right now in a designated stroke center. So if you have a stroke, go to a designated stroke center.
That's definitely the message.
Yeah.
I want to thank you both. What an uplifting story. What a happy story. And we're just so pleased that you were willing to come and share it with us.
Next up, surviving breast cancer, where to find support. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
This is Upstate's HealthLink on air, Linda Cohen along with you. According to the American Cancer Society, there are close to 3 million breast cancer survivors in the United States at this time. But surviving cancer brings with it many challenges for the person and his or her family. Well, here to tell us more about this is Dr. Jane Sharlam. She's assistant professor of surgery, obstetrics and gynecology, and medicine at the Breast Cancer Center at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Sharlam. Thanks for coming in.
I'm happy to be here.
So surviving breast cancer brings with it many challenges. Tell us about that.
There are numerous challenges for anyone who's a survivor of any cancer. I think certainly the first thing one needs to be mindful of are the physical challenges that come with the cancer itself and come as side effects of the treatment. In addition to that, though, there are many emotional concerns and wellness concerns as the patient transfers from being a cancer treatment focus to having a cancer survivorship focus.
Yeah, it strikes me that when you're in the midst of cancer and you're in the midst of treatment, your focus is getting through each step of the way. You know, when's my next chemo? What, you know, when's my next time off? How will I survive? Can I survive? And all of the energy that has to go into kind of facing that kind of challenge. But then once the treatment stops and all that attention to you kind of wanes, it would seem to me it would be a really hard time. You're left with your own anxieties, perhaps, your own concerns, and maybe a lot of unanswered questions.
That's absolutely right. And we find that patients often feel almost a letdown when the active treatment time is over. And sometimes they feel lost and almost abandoned by the medical community at large because the medical community may not see this as crisis mode anymore. We've treated this cancer. You're done with your therapy. And now the woman is forced, in this case of breast cancer, typically a woman is forced to face moving on with life and sometimes doesn't have guidance to do that.
Yeah, it strikes me also this whole issue at me because the treatment itself also can bring with it many sequelae, many secondary things. I mean, they talk about brain fog. They talk about when women have reconstruction or have had mastectomies, they have to then consider when or how to do a reconstruction. So it would seem that you really need to have some kind of an approach to help these people, a survivorship program of some kind.
Exactly, and that's what we've been looking at because there are so many physical and emotional concerns of breast cancer survivors that are unique and important.
What are some of the questions that you've seen people asking in terms of, you know, following treatment? What are the things that they have yet to be resolved?
I think a lot of women that we see are fearful about the cancer coming back, and so we do a lot of education on what she should look for. We also do a lot of education surrounding side effects of therapies she may have had, including side effects of surgery, radiation, and you mentioned some of the side effects of chemo. Unfortunately, there is something that I've heard called chemo brain or chemo fog, like you've mentioned, and that is problems with memory or attention. So that she needs to cope with that where she before she never did.
Do they know, for example, after this treatment, how often they might need to see a doctor? Do they need to have certain tests? I mean, those are the kinds of things that strike me. Or if they have pain or fatigue, what does that mean and when to become alarmed? That kind of thing.
That's something that every woman should be talking with her cancer treatment doctors about and something that we're focusing on more and more. All of the patients that go through our breast cancer treatment programs, when they finish up, we're focusing on getting them a nice written summary of exactly how she was treated and exactly what is recommended going forward so that she has a full understanding of that, that she can share with her healthcare providers and with her family.
You have a program right now, a breast cancer survivorship program. So what is its mission? What are you trying to accomplish there?
Our mission is to really ease that transition from being under active treatment from breast cancer into being in survivorship mode and onto wellness. That's our goal, is to help our breast cancer survivors move on to a life of wellness.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Jane Sharlam, and we're talking about surviving breast cancer. Well, what are some of the lifestyle changes? I mean, it's such a profound experience to face cancer and then to feel like maybe you've conquered it. I mean, You hear stories over and over again about people enjoying life in a way they never had before, or appreciating the very smallest things in their lives. But at the same time, often there need to be some lifestyle changes that have to take place. What are some of the things you recommend or see?
Some of the things that we really find are helpful are focusing a lot on exercise, diet, and stress reduction. I think those are things that many of our patients didn't think about prior to diagnosis, but become more and more important as she moves into a new life of survivorship. Many patients find that they're fatigued after treatment and that they have symptoms of depression. Depression is something that we take very seriously in our program, and we work both with emotional support and with medications to treat that. We also find that our patients that have problems with fatigue, we can help a lot through lifestyle changes, including diet, sleep changes, and exercise.
How about alcohol and smoking?
Well, for any patient, for any woman in the United States, we always, always, always want her to avoid smoking. And in particular, in women at risk for breast cancer and women with a history of breast cancer, we do recommend keeping alcohol at a minimum.
Do you find that people have special dietary needs after breast cancer treatment? I mean, does your appetite change, perhaps? I'm sure during chemotherapy it does. But following, are there particular changes to the way you like to eat or what you might want to eat?
Everybody is an individual, and it's hard to say how any individual will change as far as dietary preferences. We like to help our patients focus, though, on a healthy diet that will provide her body with energy and nutrients that can gear her towards a life of wellness.
So plant-based diet.
We look at plant-based diets. We look at lots of fruits and veggies, lots of natural fibers, avoiding processed foods, avoiding red meats as much as possible. One thing our patients often ask about is soy. Soy does contain phytoestrogens, which are natural estrogens, and there's been much research about this, and I think a lot of misinformation out there. We find that having soy in the diet in a reasonable amount should not be dangerous for women at increased risk of breast cancer or who have had a breast cancer. But we try to have our survivors avoid soy supplements that sometimes are touted as a natural way to treat menopausal symptoms. So again, as part of a normal diet, things like edamame that contain soy, we have no concerns about. But soy supplements are something that we ask our survivors to avoid.
That's a very good point, a very interesting point, because I have heard both sides of that argument, and I think it is confusing for people, whether they've had breast cancer or not,
correct,
if they're going through menopause, as to how to approach it. As far as exercise, I've seen several recent reports that say that staying active after cancer can really reduce your risk of recurrence and add to longer survival. Is there something to that?
There absolutely is. Right now, our typical recommendation is 150 minutes a week of moderate exercise or 75 minutes a week of vigorous exercise as tolerated. That might not be something she can start right away, but something that's a goal. We find, though, that more importantly than the studies showing reduction in recurrence is how our patients feel. Women that exercise routinely tend to have less problems with fatigue, less problems with depression, and generally feel much better day to day.
Yeah, I think that's true for all of us, but clearly if you've suffered from breast cancer and the treatments, it would be all the more true. So tell me about your program a little bit more. What is its mission? I mean, what are you trying, you know, what's the overall goal here? And give us let's put our arms around what the program looks like.
Sure. We have found through the years that while we were very good at treating breast cancers, when it came time for those women to leave our active treatment mode and go on into their primary care world, there was sort of a gap. There was a knowledge gap. There was an emotional support gap. And we wanted to fill that gap. So we launched this year a formal survivorship program for our breast cancer patients. And upon the completion of her active treatment, so when she's all done with surgery, all done with radiation, all done with chemotherapy, then she would be entered into the survivorship arm of our program.
And what exactly takes place? In other words, How often are they engaged? Who do they talk to? What goes on?
Sure. The first visit on our program is typically with me or one of our other physicians. And it's a long visit. It lasts over an hour. And we will go through her history with a fine-tooth comb. We'll talk to her about any symptoms she's having. We'll talk to her about her wellness concerns moving forward. And then once she's enrolled in our program, we'll see her typically between every 3 and 6 months for the first year or so. At those visits, she'll have physical exams. It'll be an opportunity to follow up on any symptoms she's having. We will go through and make sure that she's having all the follow-up studies that are recommended, both from her breast cancer routine and surveillance, but also for other general health and wellness concerns, such as colonoscopies, pelvic exams. So we will be a program that can help her organize her health care to make sure she's moving forward in the right way. Another nice piece of our program is our communication. We will be helping facilitate communication between her treating providers, her oncologists, and her primary care providers, so that when ultimately she goes back out into the world, she will be armed with a lot of information to help her providers care for her.
So how long is the program kind of at this point set up to run for an individual?
For an individual, she will be a part of our program as long as she wants to be.
Oh, really? So there's not a set date?
There's not a set date. For some women, they might find that, you know, a year or two, this is fine, and she wants to move on and pretend that things are completely normal. And for her, they are normal, and she's gone back to her healthy lifestyle. Many other survivors find that it helps to have someone checking in every once in a while.
I would think so myself.
Another piece of the program, too, is some social connections. We will be starting some survivor-to-survivor support groups down the road, and we will also have regular information educational sessions in the evenings for our survivors. And I think that's something that helps women feel connected to other survivors and men as well.
Absolutely.
And so we don't find that we want an endpoint to this program. I think a woman will be a survivor for the rest of her life.
So who is right for the program?
Any patient who has completed active treatment. Typically, our program is designed for stages 1, 2, and 3 breast cancers. However, we welcome anyone with any stage of breast cancer.
And they need not have been treated at Upstate Medical University to participate. Is that
absolutely
correct?
Absolutely not. We spend a lot of time gathering records so that we know exactly what has occurred as far as the treatment, and we more than welcome referrals from out of our upstate system.
So how does someone get involved? Is it something a direct refer? I mean, can they refer themselves, or do they need to come through a physician?
Typically, they're referred by their treating physician, but a woman can absolutely refer herself by calling our breast center.
And that number?
That number is 315-464-8224.
Wonderful. Well, this is very, very inspiring information. I really know that with all the breast cancer survivors out there, and in Central New York, clearly that we have our share, that this is very helpful to know that there are people out there that can really kind of help carry you through the journey, because it's a difficult journey. At best. So I want to thank you so much. My guest has been Dr. Jane Sharlam. She's assistant professor of surgery, obstetrics and gynecology, and medicine at the Breast Cancer Center at Upstate Medical University. Thanks so much for sharing all your very valuable information with us. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, I'm psychologist Dr. Rich O'Neill with this week's checkup from the neck up, 2009, year of the book, or today, day one of my new writing for 90 minutes a day habit. Well, folks, my computer monitor is angelic with a halo of yellow, pink, and sea green post-it notes. Next to the one reading, "Remember John, a dear friend who died young," was 2009, the year of the book, with an exclamation mark. A see it every day reminder of my New Year's resolution. Yeah, lots of things got in the way, but fact is, 2009 is long gone and no book yet. And even the post-it has disappeared. Poof. If you're in the unmet resolutions boat too. Let me recommend a really good, readable, science-based book, Changeology, Change O-L-O-G-Y, by psychologist John Norcross, that will multiply our chances of success if we put it to use. How did I mess up? Well, Norcross and the research say the acronym for Get There From Here goals is S-M-A-R-T, SMART, specific, measurable, actionable, realistic, and timed. My goal was SMERT. Specific, yes, a book. Measurable, yes, one. Realistic, yes, I like to write. And timed, yes, 1 year. But I marinated in the fantasy of a published book and didn't work consistently at smaller, doable daily goals, accent on the action. Sure, I'd jam notes of catchy titles, pithy quotes, and chapter sketches into folders. Even wrote pages 1, 2, 3, 4, and later wrote pages 1, 2, 3, 4. Stuck in Norcross's stage of contemplating chronically and preparing perpetually, and not enough sustained sweating at my keyboard. And I didn't support my sweating by tracking the time I did write, nor reward myself for what I did do. However, I'm changing. Tapping out this checkup is today's 90 minutes, to be revised for my book's intro in a later 90 minutes, and both to be jotted into my writing my book time log, already in progress, I might add. And the science says declaring our goal in public and recruiting some supporters ups our chances of success. So, will I do 90 a day? Yes, I am committing to that to you all now. And if we stick to the commit every day for 90 days, dusting off when we fall and getting right back on the unruly horse of changing ourselves and making use of a new strategy to stay on the horse, we'll have a new habit in 90 days with success following. Helps also to have a team of supporters who know how to help. Want to be on mine? You can. Just e-me how you're doing on your goal. I'll radio you with my update here in a month. Then, if I'm on track, a hearty, way to go, Rich, E would spur me on. I'll send you one, too, if you want. Hey, this is fun already. Good luck, partner. I'm Dr. Rich. 90 minutes for 90 days, O'Neill. Email me at hloa@upstate.edu. Thanks for tuning in.
Coming up next, varicose veins. Are they more than a cosmetic problem? You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, I'm Dr. Donna Bakke, Chair of Public Health and Preventive Medicine with your Healthy Monday Minute for May 12th. While food isn't a cure-all for stress, the right foods, those rich in vitamin B or antioxidants, for instance, could help balance you out by attacking the free radicals that stress releases into your body. On the other hand, alcohol, caffeine, and sugared foods can contribute to negative mood swings and really bad breath. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Well, giving birth to three babies left me with gnarled, enlarged, bluish veins that look like a road map to nowhere all over my legs. But varicose veins can happen to anyone of either gender, and for a variety of reasons. Well, here with more on this is Dr. Palma Shaw, Associate Professor of Surgery in the Division of Vascular and Endovascular Surgery at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Shaw. Thanks for coming.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's start by understanding, what do we actually mean when we say varicose veins? What are they?
varicose veins are dilated superficial veins, often seen on the lower extremities, that may be worsened over time with age, generally not present when you're very young, and as you're older, you may be developing them. They may be bothersome to people, or they may not be problematic at all. It depends upon the person and depends upon other factors, such as whether or not they've had children, depends upon family history. It depends upon what their job is. People who stand on their feet all day are at greater risk of having symptoms related to the varicose veins.
So let's get to that exactly. So what exactly will cause them? I mean, you said they don't show up when you're young, but there have to be causative factors. I mean, in my case, 3 pregnancies brought them on. But is there a genetic predisposition to this?
There is. Frequently, patients who have varicose veins may have had a parent or a relative that has had varicose veins as well. Varicose veins are problematic because they dilate. And when they dilate, the little valves that help the blood move forward in a certain direction can no longer really prevent the blood from backfilling. So then when you're standing on your feet all day and if the valves aren't working, the blood is actually sort of pooling down in your legs. And over time, the legs don't particularly appreciate that, and it may cause muscle cramping or achiness or fatigue of the legs over time.
So does aging increase your risk as well? I mean, you mentioned that it doesn't really show up when you're young. Is it? And what about weight? Does weight
obesity is a risk factor for development of varicose veins and chronic venous insufficiency, which really means having veins in general that are not working properly.
So that there's some kind of malfunctioning of the venous flow that would lead you to then have these enlarged veins.
That's correct.
So besides, I mean, in my case, fortunately, I don't have pain. But I hear from so many people that these veins are killing them. I mean, they cause a lot of pain. But what else would be some symptoms that would accompany this problem?
So sometimes patients will present and say that their legs are hurting, and I think it's important for a physician to try to differentiate whether that pain is really related to the veins or related to another underlying problem. But once you identify that it is, in fact, the veins that is bothering the patient, it may be that they say that in the morning their legs feel fine and that by the end of the day their legs feel very heavy and achy. Sometimes they get itching over the veins. Sometimes they throb and ache. It may also vary depending upon a woman's menstrual cycle. Sometimes the veins are more painful during their menses than other times in the month. And it may also depend upon how much activity or how much they've been on their feet.
So it's worse if they sit or stand for a very long time, generally.
Correct.
But this is not just in women. Obviously, we're talking about women because of the whole pregnancy attachment. But the fact is this happens in men as well.
It does happen in men. I just find that men will come in a little later. Usually when the men present complaining about their varicose veins, they're very advanced and they're quite extensive.
And more extreme.
And then they're at more risk.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with vascular surgeon Dr. Palma Shaw, and we're talking about varicose veins. So they are a common problem. A lot of people have them, and it's always been in my estimation that they were not a sign of a more serious problem, but they can be, can't they?
They can be. First of all, if they're really giving the patient pain, that may actually affect their ability to work. It may affect their day-to-day life, and it's a quality of life issue. On a more serious note, patients who have varicose veins are also at greater risk for problems such as clots in the veins. So the superficial veins that are pooling with blood sitting there, that blood can clot, and then they will get pain, and then that clot could extend.
Tell us about that, because I know that they talk about thrombophlebitis. Tell me about some of the different possibilities that can occur.
So there are 2 different kinds. One is the superficial thrombophlebitis, which means a clot in the varicose veins that you see under the skin. And then there's deep veins that are affected that also can have thrombophlebitis, and those are the dangerous ones. It's dangerous when you get a clot in the deep vein system, the deeper veins that are encompassed within the muscles within the leg, and if the clot forms in those veins, it can break off and go to the lung, and then you can have a pulmonary embolism and you could die.
So let's get this straight. So because of the pooling of blood, because the veins don't work correctly, the blood sits there, clots can form, and especially in the deep veins, which is called deep vein thrombosis, that kind of pooling or those kinds of clots can, as you said, break off. They become what we call emboli once they break off, and they can travel through the body. Is it just the lungs that they go to? I know that's called a pulmonary embolus, but are there other types of problems as well, other parts of the body they can go to?
Most often they go to the lungs, but they also go through the heart to go to the lungs. So if there is an anomaly where there's a hole in the heart, even a small one that the patient's totally unaware of, then the clot can pass from the venous side of the body over to the arterial side of the body, and then the patient can actually have a stroke.
So that is very serious.
It is very serious, but it's not nearly as common as a pulmonary embolus.
So tell us what happens with a pulmonary embolus. What's the danger there?
Because that when the clot goes and blocks off the flow to a certain part of the lung, then you can't get enough oxygen. And then also the lung will respond by constricting. And so even the part that's blocked off will have an extra portion of the lung that's also not getting oxygen.
Does part of the lung tissue therefore then die? I mean, is there a danger to damaging your lungs as well?
I think it depends upon how much of the lung has been affected and how big the clot has been. But if the clot is large enough, then it can actually affect the heart, and you could die.
So basically, what kind of symptoms would you notice with a pulmonary embolus?
You may notice just shortness of breath with trying to be more active, or you may have severe chest pain.
So this is serious business.
That's very serious.
What kinds of treatments can we offer for just the standard garden variety varicose veins? I mean, are there home treatments? Is there lifestyle changes? What should people be doing for those?
So first we do prevention and we try to manage these things conservatively. We recommend the patients, if they're overweight, they lose weight, they exercise. And then we also prescribe support stockings, which I find to be very effective and very helpful. And I strongly encourage my patients to use them.
Those are compression stockings.
Correct.
That somehow, how does that help?
So the thing is that many patients have a misunderstanding about these stockings so when they come in the office, they don't even want to wear them because they've had a bad experience. The stockings that I'm talking about that are actually a medical grade with a prescription stocking are actually measured for your specific leg. So you go to a fitting store or a pharmacy that dispenses stockings. They do special measurements on your leg, at your ankle, the calf, and the thigh, and the lengths. And then they prescribe a certain size. And then these stockings have certain compression strengths. So, for example, you might have what's a 30-millimeter compression at the foot and ankle, and then it decreases as it goes up to 20. The reason that's important is that it's a reverse gradient. So you've got damaged valves, you've got blood pooling, and gravity is pulling the blood down, and the stockings are pumping it up.
So they literally help the blood move up.
Correct.
And so that you avoid this idea of pooling and potential development of clots and all of that. And does it also alleviate pain?
Yes, and then the patients feel much better. They have more energy, and they have less swelling. Once you've undergone an adequate treatment time frame of the stockings, if the patient's not fully improved, then you could consider other therapies. So then we would do an ultrasound of the leg and see exactly what veins are involved and how damaged the valves are. If the saphenous system, which is the superficial system, is very damaged, there are treatments for that where we treat the saphenous vein. The old-fashioned way to do it was stripping, where we actually make incisions and tear out the vein. But the newest therapies are simply treated with a needle puncture, and we burn the vein, whether it's with radiofrequency energy or with a laser.
Is that called sclerotherapy or laser surgery?
So the sclerotherapy is utilized for spider veins or spider telangiectasias. Those are the very tiny, less than 3-millimeter veins you see on the skin of the legs that can be treated with either a topical laser or injections with a soap solution or an irritant. Most of the time, those are actually cosmetic, and infrequently are they paid for by insurances.
So those are really cosmetic, not for health reasons.
It's the larger varicose veins, more than 3 millimeters in size, that tend to be problematic. And when you want to treat those, you also have to determine whether you should treat the vein the saphenous system as well, because that if that's diseased, it's feeding those varicose veins.
So the system, tell me about that very briefly. What do you mean by the system? You mean the entire network of veins that we're talking about?
So in the leg, the veins are set up such that it's almost like a ladder. So if you have two lines in parallel and then rungs between, you have a deep system in the middle of the leg and a superficial system towards the outer side of the leg under the skin, and then you've got connectors like rungs. So you have a deep system, a superficial system, and a perforator system. The majority of patients are affected by the superficial system that we can treat. So what we do is we would work that up, see if that particular vein is the problem, and we can treat that. We do only treat that vein if it's really diseased, because that is a vein that we use as vascular surgeons for heart bypass and also for leg bypasses. So we don't want to do that if the vein's not damaged. But if it is damaged, we have many new modalities to treat that.
What's something called a phlebectomy? What does that mean?
So once you determine whether or not you have to treat anything deeper, then you can treat the varicose veins that you see. And those we can treat with tiny little incisions where we tease out the vein and then we pull out the vein, hold pressure, and that will get rid of the vein.
Is anything done endoscopically as well? Or do you always have to do an open procedure?
There's another way to manage the varicosities. It's a transluminal approach where you actually put in a mechanism, almost like a little bit of a lens and a telescope with a machine that will actually morselate the veins and chop up the veins and then suck it out.
Wow. So it's less invasive in a way?
I think it depends on how you look at it. I think they're equally invasive myself.
So when you talk about the ladder, just clarify that, because I'm not exactly clear what you said, the saphenous system and the ladder. Is the idea here to treat the superficial veins and not the deep veins?
Right, you need the deep veins. The deep veins carry 90% of the blood in your body.
So you don't want to mess with them.
You want that to work as well as possible.
Yeah.
But the superficial system, especially if it's not working to your advantage, can be removed or ablated, burned, or treated. And when we burn the vein, then the blood just gets rerouted
to the
deep system.
So the point is you're not without circulation.
Correct.
You really have full circulation, then they can be treated.
No.
So what's the takeaway in the very little time we have left? What do you tell patients? What should they do?
I think they should be evaluated. They should be evaluated by a specialist. They have to be open to wearing support stockings and conservative measures, and then we have to do the workup to determine what's right for each patient.
Well, I want to thank you. This is very enlightening information, and many of us who suffer from varicose veins will be very grateful to have it. My guest has been Dr. Palma Shaw. She's an associate professor in the Department of Surgery in the Division of Vascular and Endovascular Surgery at Upstate Medical University. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, here's Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate's award-winning literary and visual journal, The Healing Muse, with a selection about grief.
Thank you, Linda. Sometimes we feel frustrated by poetry's seeming ambiguity. We want to know for sure what the poem means. Part of the reason I see The Healing Muse as such a good complement to the medical university is that medicine, too, can frustrate us with its uncertainties. Poet Zara Raab writes a very short poem entitled Grieving. She begins with a memory from the past that only hints at a sister's reason for behaving strangely. But then she quickly puts us in the present day to explain how her title has again come to haunt her. Here is Zara Raab's Grieving. The summer you went wild, you hid at the creek by the house, a grieving child, while father searched the marsh. Blackberries stained our fingers, their tartness in our sweet mouths stung and lingered, clotting our mother's death. Red juices matting our curls, under the summer stars we sighed like water purling the rushes along the byways. Winter now, the creek like glass. What has become of us, I ask and ask. Just now, nothing soothes my loss. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we get an update on a new drug for treating cystic fibrosis. Plus, we'll explore the latest techniques for breast reconstruction and learn all about that lethal cancer of the esophagus. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's HealthLinkOnAir, that's all one word, .org. And to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, look for us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Becky Serio and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.